Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Okay, guys, this bonus episode is epic. You will not want to miss it. Last month, I was able to talk with Bob Ruff, who is an icon, an idol. I was so thankful to have him on our show. He is the incredible host of both the Truth and Justice podcast, as well as True Crime Binge. I was on his show a couple months ago, True Crime Binge, where he talks with different true crime content creators, different authors, different podcasters, and whatnot. What he does on Truth and Justice is crowdsource investigations in real time. So he's asking his listeners to help him with the investigations as he takes on new potential wrongful conviction cases. Bob helped free Ed Ates of a wrongful conviction, and he's been close with the West Memphis 3 case. He has been close with the Adnan Syed case, and we get into these cases in our interview today. On top of his incredible podcasting journey, Bob was also the host and a producer on Oxygen's The Forgotten West Memphis 3 TV miniseries that aired back in 2020. He's really cool, you guys, and he knows his stuff. So I'm very glad he's able to come on our podcast and share with you guys the details into some of these cases that I could have never given you without him. I'm going to forewarn you real quick before we jump into it that when I interviewed him, my voice was on the brink of death, actually was coming out of death. It was horrifying and I did my best to sound normal, but thankfully Bob talks most of the time, so you don't have to listen to me too much. Just bear through my raspy, raspy voice. With that, let's jump into it. So, Bob, I am so grateful that you're here with me today. Thank you for being here.
Oh, I'm happy. I'm happy to join you anytime.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about wrongful convictions with you, especially just because I think a lot of people have a hard time wrapping their mind around wrongful convictions. And I think the more knowledge they have, the better we can understand these things and obviously like do advocacy work like you're doing. But before we get into all of that, I would love to talk about how you got into the true crime podcasting. You were a firefighter before this.
Right. Yeah, it was kind of an accident, really. I'm never mm-hmm. So I was just at Obsessed Fest a few weeks ago. And they put me in to play like true crime Jeopardy and true crime Family Feud and found out that I know very little about true crime. I've never been a big true crime fan. Okay. Yeah, so I was, as most people know, I was a fireman, and I was I listened to a lot of like comedy podcasts mostly, actually, and one of the shows mm-hmm. that I listened to regularly kept talking about the Serial podcast. I had no idea what it was, mm-hmm. so I listened to the Serial podcast, and I went into it having I didn't know it was about true crime. I had no idea what it was. All I know was that Jimmy Pardo kept bitching about the fact that they kept saying that it was like the first podcast and he'd been around for longer. So I tuned it in.
He's like, no, mine is.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. I tuned in just having no idea. I'm like, well, what is this thing everybody's talking about? And just like everyone else, I was hooked with the story and hooked with the case. And, you know, I was also an arson investigator as well. So like that kind of investigative part of my mind was like, wait a minute, this is like a puzzle that, and then it was over and it was like, we didn't figure this out. Like, let's go. So I start, you know, I was trying to get anybody I knew to listen to it. Very few people that I knew were listening to it. So I literally started back then, Truth and Justice Now, what was Serial Dynasty, one day my kid was homesick. I actually had some podcasting equipment that I'd bought for another project before this. And I was like, well, maybe I'll have this idea like a book club since none of my friends will talk to me about it. My wife's sick and tired of hearing me talk about it. And so if you listen to like season one, episode one of Truth and Justice, it's me going like, hey, guys, so I'm interested in the Adnan Syed Haymon Lee case. And I think you are, too. So why don't you tell me what you think? And then we'll talk about it. And I kind of like tracked along. Yeah. And I kind of tracked along with Undisclosed. And I would like read emails people would send in. And it just it went from there to being like, you know, kind of ran out of just material that was out there and started like I had unanswered questions. And I started reaching out to witnesses and kind of before I knew it, I was in the middle of my own investigation into the case. Had never intended to do that. And then from there, people started writing in asking me to cover other cases and the rest is just kind of history.
That's really cool. I didn't realize that you just became like obsessed with that case and almost just got yourself involved in it. Is that how you met like Rabia Chaudhry and got really involved with her?
Yeah, I've always said that I really owe my career because, you know, I left the fire department less than a year later, took an early retirement and started podcasting full time. I owe my career to Rabia because when I started putting out the Serial Dynasty episodes, she was listening. She probably had Google alerts or something set up on the case.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and was listening to it. And then she started tweeting about it. And then all of a sudden my audience was growing very rapidly, very quickly because Rabia was tweeting about my show. And then she mentioned it on Undisclosed a couple of times. And then that's, and so eventually, you know, I had Susan and Colin and Rabia on as guests. I did interviews with them. And then as we got further and further into it, then it got to be Rabia and I definitely got to be very close friends. We're still married. She was just texting me before I came in here to record this. We got to be, you know, very close friends. And we were, you know, Susan and Colin were the two more reserved people on on Undisclosed, where Rabia was like, Bob, let's solve this thing. Let's go. And so we, you know.
She wanted to do this.
Yeah. So she and I started kind of working together like that. And then, since then, we've just been really good friends and have been working through that case, you know, together for years and years since then.
Yeah, and she's done really incredible work with Adnan Syed. And there's a little bit of controversy around Serial now, right?
Yeah.
So how is that for you, like going into it, being so obsessed with that show and that's really what got you into it and then just working through like what's problematic?
Well, I mean, for me, and I know this is like there's the narrative out there that is, Serial left questions unanswered, but without Serial, then we wouldn't Adnan wouldn't be free now. But I don't believe that at all. You know, Rabia was the driving force behind it. You know, and Sarah Koenig was the first journalist she reached out to, who told the story, and it was a captivating. And she was a great storyteller. But to think that Rabia wouldn't have continued on that journey without Sarah Koenig is ridiculous. But yeah, I mean, I lost a lot of respect for Sarah Koenig when, you know, when the case like got back at, first of all, I started doing my show and no one gave a shit. It was called Serial Dynasty. And then all of a sudden the show got bigger. And then at one point I passed Serial in the podcast charts and then immediately get a cease and desist letter from This American or from the Serial people telling me to stop using their, which it was, you know, like my lawyer was like, they don't own the name Serial. Like, they can't do that. It didn't matter because I was rebranding anyway. But, and then when Adnan went to court in 2016, it was like Sarah told the story and then had nothing to do with it. And then it was like, oh, he's back in court again now. Well, now I want to be involved again. And then, you know, his conviction was overturned and reinstated, disappears again. And then it's like, oh, now he's, you know, we're back in court again and he's getting out. And it's like, boom, she's, you know, she's in every picture right there with the microphone. And she did, you know, what really got me was she did an update episode and gave Rabia no credit for what's that thoroughly pissed me off. How did she put it? It was not a quote, but to paraphrase it, she said something along the lines of she had done all this work on Adnan's case, and then, you know, Rabia had brought it to her, and Rabia even did kind of her own little thing, is how she put it. no mention of the Undisclosed podcast, the tireless work right. that her and Susan and Colin did and the people that were helping them. So just you know, acted like, you know, Rabia just, she did her own little thing. It was irritating.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I think Rabia, I won't speak for Rabia, but I know that there's problems too that Sarah may, you know, people are like, well, she stayed neutral. She stayed by, but she didn't, because she had access to a lot of information that mm-hmm. she intentionally kept out of that story to keep the story more ambiguous. That's not neutral journalism.
Being neutral.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When it was, you know, it's like we spent, what, an entire episode on whether or not Adnan stole money out of the collection plate at the mosque. You know, mm-hmm. when there were other huge issues that she had information about that she left out because she wanted to keep it neutral and ambiguous. And it just, yeah, it, I'm not a fan. I guess I'll
yeah, I've mostly gained any of my knowledge about Serial being problematic from Robbie's Twitter.
Uh-huh.
Is really kind of where I saw it, because I've heard Serial as I started listening to podcasts. I think in the beginning, probably like you, a lot of people just started listening to it, mm-hmm. and I never heard really anything negative. And then with Adnan being freed, I've been following Rabia's Twitter a lot, mm-hmm. and she was, you know, posting about it, and I've been following along with that. So she really gave me like the knowledge that it was problematic. I actually, this is kind of funny, I didn't listen to Serial myself through like the whole thing. I listened to Patrick and Jillian's coverage on True Crime Obsessed. They covered Serial in their Patreon, and they, I just love them, and they're mm-hmm. funny. And so I, that's really where I heard about her episodes, and I kind of just followed her coverage of it through them. But yeah, so it sounds like Sarah was a little more focused on it being a podcast and like the popularity of her podcast versus really following through with the case.
That's the way it feels to me. And what I won't take away from Sarah Koenig and the team at This American Life that put it together is they're great. She's a great storyteller. Like she told yeah. a great, compelling story that left everyone asking questions. Problem with it mm-hmm. is it's not a story. It's a real person's, several people's real lives that she was talking about yeah. with real impacts and mm-hmm. to intentionally leave people on the fence when she had information that probably would have leaned them the other way had she truly been neutral about mm-hmm. it is where my problem is. That was a problem I had with it. Her saying Rabia just did her own little thing. That's when I was like, okay, fuck you, Sarah. Sorry, I don't know if you swear on your show. I hope you have a beep button.
No, you're fine. Yeah. You're like, hey, that's enough. I mean, because you might as well give credit where credit's due when you're yeah. collabing with people and you all, if you all have the same goal and intention in mind, right. why would you not want to like give them a shout out, especially Rabia, who's yeah. put so much work.
Well, that was the thing, is there's this weird like competitive deal with her, and like clearly it doesn't yeah. have to exist. You know, Rabia and I were both doing podcasts about the same case at the same time and collabed together as much as we possibly could throughout that process. Mm-hmm. Whereas we go to the – I still remember going to the hearing, and Sarah was at that hearing in 2016. Now, like, she had sent me a letter, and I walked by and just – and I said hi. Like, at that point, I was like, oh, it's Sarah Koenig. Hi, Sarah. I'm Bob Ruff.
Yeah.
And she just looked at me and was like, oh, who the hell are you? Which I guess is understandable. But she didn't even acknowledge Rabia. She just walked right by Rabia, didn't even say hi to her or nothing. And at that point, Rabia never yeah. said anything negative about her. I think it's just mm-hmm. very much like, I want to be the best. I want to be the voice of the story. And she's not. Rabia, and Susan, like, and Colin are the voice of a non-story.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's plenty of people in this world that there's many people who can tune into multiple shows. It doesn't have to be. I mean, someone's yeah. life, like you said, their real life story isn't mm-hmm. owned by one single person. And the more people talking about it, the better.
100%. So yeah.
That is very strange. Like behavior, I guess, when you're covering a story. Mm-hmm. I saw on Twitter as well, through Rabia, there was this tweet, and you commented on it as well, where mm-hmm. this person was saying, like, it's so dangerous to put this narrative out there for people that are wrongfully convicted that probably actually did it. I don't remember exactly how it read, but I was wondering how you guys deal with that being like the voice for someone that was wrongfully convicted. You obviously like very much believe in Adnan. I do as well. So when people are coming at you like that, acting like, you know, you're doing the wrong thing, mm-hmm. how is that to like combat?
I mean, there's a sliding scale over the years. It used to really bother me. I really used to feel like I needed to respond to every negative comment, and you get, it's not even really getting jaded to, but it's just kind of like you get used to, it's like, okay, when you're covering wrongful convictions, they're by nature going to be controversial. There's always going to be a sect of people that believe the person that you think is innocent is guilty, and the internet's mm-hmm. a nasty place. So they're going to come and be ugly and nasty as much as they can on the internet. So over the years, for the most part, I just ignore it. I don't look at mm-hmm. anything that comes, you know, I just scroll past it. I don't, you know, I'll block people sometimes, but I don't do a lot of social media in general. You know, just because of the ugliness on the internet. That particular, I know the one you're talking about. That just happened to be enough of my friends, my real life friends that are on Twitter had commented on it, that it was like,
you're like I'm done.
In my feed, like, Bob, look, look, you know, and it was, I don't even know who this person was, but they made,
no.
but they were like, you know, they had a pretty big following, and they were talking about how irresponsible it was to cover these wrongful convictions. And what pissed me off was they said, you know, with the obvious murderer Adnan Syed, horrible, vile murderer Adnan Syed. And something about it just triggers, like, if you have such a level of cognitive dissonance that you cannot even bring yourself at this point to say, okay, maybe. I'm not even saying to agree that, but you know, when you know, Jay has changed his story over and over again now, even since Serial came out, has changed his story. He's out of it. All of the evidence that's been disproven. I think the key thing in the entire case is the Coach Sy's alibi that was proven by the undisclosed team that, you know, there was one single day where they practiced outside during Ramadan, and it was the day that Hay was killed, that he has a solid alibi. Mm-hmm. And then the district attorney, that the office that prosecuted him, said there's two other viable suspects with me. One of them has means, motives, and opportunity. And we've done DNA testing, and we found DNA on the scene that does not belong to Hay or Adnan. Excuse me. All these, and they say the conviction, we do not have faith in this conviction, and they let it. When all that is going on, and you still maintain the position of he's 100% murdering ass, like, give me a break. Like, you're not being intellectually honest with yourself if you can't at least say, you know what? Maybe there's something going on here. I'm going to hold off into calling somebody this horrible thing until we see how this shakes out. To be that insistent that they're right. That was what got me with that comment. I don't remember what I commented back, but I remember doing it.
I don't remember either. I just kind of saw it and thought, like, that would be so frustrating mm-hmm. to get comments like that. And like you said, when everybody, like, there's all these things that play into it, to not even take a step back and be like, maybe, like, I'm not really sure on this. But I noticed one of the comments said something along the lines of, like, the court system is not just going to let people out on murder chart, like, who they have as a convicted murderer because you and Rabia say so. And I was like, exactly.
Yeah, that's ridiculous, like, to think that. You know, and you have the same group with, you know, in my season 5, I covered the West Memphis 3 case. You have the same type of people there that, like, they were literally like, well, Jesse Ms. Kelly confessed 7 times. It's like, have you listened to literally 100% of every single expert ever that's listened that has all said?
Literally.
He knows nothing. Understand. All of that information came from the police. It's just like I said, they're people just are not being intellectually honest that they can't even – if they can't even get to a point of ambiguity where it's just like, no, 100%. And is so, like, Adnan's case, the West Memphis 3 case. So go back to when it all began, right? To the point when this mm-hmm. person established that opinion and what information was out there. And then back now go through all the different information that's come out about that case since. You're telling me that zero of that, none of that had any impact whatsoever on your feelings on the case. Like you can't right. tell me that's true. You know, it's people are just no. so, and that's why, because people say, well, shouldn't you be interacting and taking criticism? I don't have any problem taking criticism. I'm just not listening to idiot assholes on the internet. Like it doesn't faze me. Somebody who, like I said, establishes an opinion with X number of facts, and then over the course of years gets 50 new facts that come in that are actual facts, and that doesn't sway right. their opinion at all, well, then I'm not wasting my time having yeah. a conversation with that person.
Yeah, it's people who are not taking in the new information, like not almost not even accepting the new information, just being stuck in mm-hmm. their opinion of way back, long ago, before all this stuff was out, and then not critically thinking, I guess, just believing what they were told way back then.
There will be people, like hypothetically, let's say that the DNA that was found on Hayes' shoes comes back to be one of these two suspects that were identified by the DA. And that mm-hmm. person has no excuse, no reason, no any reason, possibility of having put their DNA on those shoes. 100%. They mm-hmm. have found the killer with scientific evidence. I guarantee there will still be people that will insist Anand Syed's guilty.
Absolutely. That happened when I came on your show. I talked about Angie Dodge's case where Christopher mm-hmm. Tapp was wrongfully convicted here out of Idaho Falls. And even when he was exonerated because his DNA didn't match, there were still interviews with Ken Brown, who was one of the officers that did his interrogations. He still maintained that he believed, even yeah. if the DNA matched someone, he still thinks Chris was there. Like, he could not let go mm-hmm. of the fact that he didn't match. And he said himself, if it happens to be someone else, I still believe Chris helped.
Yeah. And what's your reason for that? Well, it's because that's who I picked years ago that must have been the right person. So how could I have been wrong?
Right. And it's funny to me with law enforcement, how they want to maintain their position so badly, almost like for their pride or to like save face. But it would look so much better for them if they could just come out and say, I was wrong. Like, we were wrong.
Yeah.
We apologize.
Well, and to be fair, there are police officers and district attorneys out there that do that. There are Yeah, like for me, like people think, oh, you must hate cops and DA. I don't at all. I hate bad cops.
Yeah.
Bad DA. Exactly. You know, like Mosby, you know, she's mm-hmm. in that position and she looked at the case and said, guys, we screwed up here.
Yeah.
Then he needs to go home. He lost 23 years of his life. He needs to go home. There's, you know, one of the experts, you know, that I brought on in my investigation into the Jesse Miss Kelly confession was Jim Trainum. You know, he kind of got into that line of work because he used the Reed technique. And, you know, he's like one of the world's false confession experts worldwide now. Mm-hmm. And all that came to be because when he was a detective, he interviewed this woman, used the Reed technique and got her to confess to the crime. And then later was reviewing the evidence and realized there was evidence showing that she was across town when the crime happened. And he went back to her and went to the court and said, guys, that was a false confession. Like, we have proof here. She didn't do it. Like, maybe. Wow. So there are good cops out there,
course,
but there are also bad cops out there.
Mm-hmm. I wish, like, the other people who are trying to save their face could just see that, like, they're going to be so much better off if they just follow that lead. So
the thing is, like, cops are human beings, and so they're good and bad. There's mm-hmm. there's everything in between there. It's just like people on the internet, right?
Yes.
They're all just people. Like, there's mm-hmm. there's good ones and there's bad, there's really bad ones.
Yeah.
You know, it's a spectrum.
Yeah, I've said on my podcast many times, like, there are good and bad eggs within every group. Like, every part of life, there's good and bad eggs in religion, in law enforcement, in mm-hmm. whatever. You know, you're going to find that everywhere. So I read a few articles when Adnan was being released, and it seemed like Hayes' family was a little bit disappointed. Do you know if they're struggling a little bit with him being let out? I mean, ultimately, hopefully they can actually find who really killed her and it can come full circle for them. But I didn't know if, you know, right now it was hard.
I think that Young Lee, who's Hayes' brother, has, in my opinion, just from mm-hmm. my observing from the outside, it seems to me that he has a lawyer that's taking advantage of him. And I say that because, you know, the mm-hmm. lawyers at the hearing when the conviction was overturned, you know, wanted to delay it because he wasn't given enough notice and he couldn't be there. And, you know, the judge was like, well, we told him last week and we gave him a Zoom link to be here. And he said, well, he's at work. And so she said, OK, well, we'll wait then. We'll mm-hmm. delay for a half hour and let him come after work and he can come on Zoom and say his piece. And so when they did that, we got to hear his piece. And what he said was, you know, he feels betrayed. He feels like the district attorney was – the prosecution was on his side. But mm-hmm. what he also said was, but the idea that the person that killed my sister has been out there and free for 23 years kills me. And so I trust the DA to do the right thing.
Oh.
And that was right out of his mouth mm-hmm. where he said, you know, the way I took that was – I thought you guys got the right guy. You guys, you know, I thought we were on the same team here. Now you're telling me that he's not the right guy. I don't know if he is or not. I don't want you to let the right guy or let him out if he did it. But at the same time, if someone else did it, I want you to go freaking get him.
Yeah.
Is what he said. Now, after the fact, his attorney so there's a whole political mess there because
of course.
The attorney general, Brian Frosch, had that case file for 7 years before Marilyn Mosby got it, and Marilyn Mosby finds all this Brady material in there. She says they were hiding it and not disclosing it to the defense. They say, oh, it was in there the whole time. So she publicly calls them out. Then suddenly this other attorney for Young Lee comes out and says, well, we're going to file an appeal, and the attorney, Brian Frosch himself, is the one that's going to defend it. And to me, there's just a lot of – you've got – it appears that you have an attorney general that just got egg all over his face that's trying mm-hmm. to clean up his own mess, and you've got an attorney that's playing ball with him and is – it looks like he's taking advantage of Young because, he – I heard what he said. I heard what he said when – or I didn't hear it, but I read what he said
mm-hmm.
when he had his chance to speak. And then to say that he has this like huge issue with this and wants to undo it, that just doesn't jive with me with what he said when he spoke.
No, that actually sounds so much different than what I read, where like the narrative that right. I read was more that he was upset. But what you said makes sense, where he sounds more frustrated with the DA and, you know, the people who he thought had mm-hmm. the right person. And now he wants
yeah.
the actual right person. That makes a lot more sense. I'm glad yeah. I asked
sure,
you that.
I'm sure he's conflicted on all yeah. of it, and I'm sure it's hard on him. But you know, his words were that he hates the idea that the person that killed his sister could have been out free for the last 23 years.
Yeah.
And he trusts that the DA will do the right thing. He put his faith in Marilyn Mosby to make the right decision. Mm-hmm. And I think that she did.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So with... they came out, they had like 30 days to decide if they were going to recharge him or not, right? So, mm-hmm. And you might have to explain it to me. I'm not sure if I'm reiterating it perfectly, but will they be able to charge him in the future? Or was that like they had 30 days and now they can't come back for him again? Or like, how is that working?
I think, I'm not a lawyer, but I believe, so... when the conviction was overturned, it started a 30-day clock that says you have 30 days to either say – because, you know, they – because he was over – the conviction was not overturned based on actual innocence. It was overturned based on constitutional violations.
Okay.
So technically what happened was that conviction was vacated and a new trial was ordered when the conviction was overturned. So where that puts – I just tell people where that puts the defendant – in like the space-time continuum is like if you go back in time now to where he's been arrested and he's waiting trial. So it basically puts him back at 1999. The okay. trial never happened. He's arrested. In mm-hmm. his case, they let him go free but gave him an ankle monitor.
Okay.
But they can't drag – some states will drag this out forever. In Maryland, evidently, they you have 30 days to tell the court, we want to retry him, give us a date, or we're dropping the charges from him. You can't just keep him in this limbo indefinitely.
Right.
Well, then it was 3 weeks later, when Marilyn Mosby said, we're waiting on some DNA results. So we'll see. 3 weeks later, they got the DNA results. They found a mixture of two people's DNAs that were not Adnan's, Jay's, or Hayes on her shoes. And that was enough. And she said, now we are officially dropping the charges. So the charges are dropped. He is back to before he was arrested.
The clock doesn't need an ankle monitor. Isn't being tracked.
Yep. He's back to where he was not even arrested yet. Now, could a DA later, Marilyn Mosby obviously won't.
Yeah.
They have collected, I think they've gotten all the DNA results they can get. They've got all the physical evidence. She knows the case. She doesn't think there's a case there. Now, when she leaves office, and Ivan Bates, I think is the guy that is taking over for her in February or January. When he takes over, technically, I believe he could say, I'm looking at this evidence, and I'm going to go ahead and charge you again and charge you for this and take him back. That's not going to happen for several reasons. One, Bates has been outspoken in the past that he believes there was many problems with that conviction, and mm-hmm. he kind of promised to work on the case already. So he's already on the same side of this issue as Marilyn Mosby was. Two, even if Kevin Urich himself, which was the original prosecutor, even if he somehow gets elected and gets in there, if someone tried to take Adnan Syed back to trial right now, remember, there was never any physical evidence. It was all this weird circumstantial stuff.
Yep.
So now they have to go without Jay. First of all, I don't think Jay would ever testify again. Secondly, he would never, like I said, he's changed his story even since then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many different versions of the story now. Plus, you know, in his interviews with the HBO documentary and the things he said then, Jay's off the table. He can't mm-hmm. go. So that was their primary piece of evidence. And they used the cell phone data to corroborate Jay's story, even though that's what it was built around. If you study the case, they took the cell phone data and had him build the story around it. But so it was like Jay told a story. Here comes the cell phone expert. They literally put it on a board in front of the jury. He goes, well, Jay said at 7 o'clock they're at the burial site, and he got a call from Christy. Look here on the cell phone records. At 7 o'clock, a call comes in from Christy that hits this tower in this place, right? So that's what convicted. Well, since then, it's been proven that the cell phone records are completely unreliable, and all those cannot be used.
Mm-hmm,
so now they have to go to trial. Yeah, they have to go to trial. That's what the conviction was overturned the first time for.
Okay.
So now they would have to go to trial without Jay, without cell phone records, without any fingerprints, without any DNA, without any witnesses, with nothing. So there's just no possible way that they could possibly take him back and try him again.
Yeah, it's just not going to happen. So it could, but not likely.
Yeah, not in the real world.
Were you able to go out there and be like there when he was let out?
No. So first of all, it happened way too fast. Like, I found out on Sunday that there was a hearing on Monday.
Yeah.
You know, I remember seeing tweets. Yeah. So I'm trying to think back about it. So it was Wednesday because we were recording our follow-up episode, and we do it on Twitter, on YouTube Live.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, like, while we were recording through the chat, Marilyn Mosby has announced that she filed a motion with a judge to overturn the conviction. Well, I've worked in Texas for a long time. And I've had people that have stamped, like, you're going to be released, and it takes 6 months before they get out. So I'm like, great, now we just have to go before a judge. Hopefully a judge agrees with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was, like, Sunday afternoon. Like I said, I don't do social media. So, like, the weekend, like, I'm oblivious.
Yeah.
somebody had texted me, and they're like, holy shit, there's the hearing's tomorrow. Are you going to Baltimore? I was like, you mean in 6 hours?
Like no.
What are you talking about? Yeah. So then it just all happened way too fast.
So
and then
crazy.
Like, I of course wanted to be there. You know, I want to be there at some point, but I've said this before on my show that, like, right now is not, like, this is not my story to tell. It's Rabia's story to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And Adnan needs time with his family. And, you know, I would love to go shake his hand and sit down and meet Adnan in person. But that time will come. Right now, I just want him to be able to do what he needs to do with his family and with Rabia and everybody else. So I'm just kind of just staying out of the way right now.
Yeah. And she was able to be there. I saw she went. You kind of did. I actually should have thought of this before I even asked if you went, because I actually saw you did, like, I don't know, a little live type thing or like a conversation where you guys were waiting for?
Just kind of on a whim. I was trying to write a script on the day that the hearing was going to happen. And I was like, I was sitting in my office by myself. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, what could I do where I can be with other people? So I just went on our fan page for Truth and Justice and said, hey, here's a Zoom link. Anybody that wants to hop on Zoom and hang out with me while we watch this.
Yeah.
And, you know, thinking that, you know, maybe a couple people would. And like within seconds, it maxed out. My Zoom account would allow 100 people on there.
Easy.
It was maxed out with 100 people.
Wow.
And so we were in Jillian Pensavalli, a friend of mine too, from True Crime Obsessed. She happened to be one of the first ones that saw it and hopped on. So Jillian and I were on there with everybody.
She's so cool.
Yeah. And then after a little while, somebody was like, you know, for the people that can't be a part of it, can you link it? So I ended up linking it to YouTube Live so that other people could join in too.
Because it just maxed out. People are, you know, very involved in that case with Adnan. So
yeah, very much.
That's really cool. I love that. So with you starting out in Adnan's case, how did you then move into the West Memphis 3 case?
Well, there was a few steps in between there. So at the end, I only ever intended on doing Adnan's case. Mm. And I didn't intend on doing that as long as I did. It was just supposed to be, you know, for fun.
Right.
I got into it, you know, and like it got to a point where I'm like having a meeting with his lawyers at one point, you know, like in Baltimore.
So it
got very real.
Yeah.
And then people started writing into me saying, hey, will you cover my son's case or my uncle's case or my brother, you know? And I was like, well, we can't, you know. I hadn't really thought about it, but I tried to figure out. I ended up, my listeners donated money to build me a little studio. And,
oh my gosh, I love it.
So I ended up doing that, and it was just a listener had written in and said that her uncle, Kenny Snow, told me the story of his wrongful conviction out of Tyler, Texas, wanted me to tell that story or to investigate his case. We did. His case led to a guy named Ed Aid's case because he had testified against Ed. Long story short, we got Ed released in 2018. He got released after 20 years.
Amazing.
And like a month ago, Kenny got released.
Yeah.
So we started doing that, and then it was just, and in that case, I connected with the Innocence Project of Texas.
Okay.
So then for our season 3, IPTX then reached out to me and said, hey, we've got a case that we could use your help on. So that was my next one. Season 4 was another IPTX case.
Uh-huh.
And then I was looking for, you know, we get case submissions off. By that point, it was like, okay, well, this is like my thing now, right? This is my job. Like, I left the fire department.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So every season is a new case. And the West Memphis 3 came about because when I was finishing up season 3 in like 2017, I study, like I said, I'm not a true crime guy at all. Like, It's fucking embarrassing. People are always like, you know, this case or that. And I'm like, yeah, I know. It's kind of like that one. Like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like, no clue.
I love
clue.
That.
Yeah. So, I would study wrongful convictions because I was trying to study Patty. I had over the years developed a relationship with Jim Clementi, who was a retired FBI profiler, who was like a mentor to me. So Jim has taught me a lot, you know, so I'm constantly trying to learn this job that I have now that I have no training to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so Jim has taught me a lot and would literally like run scenarios by me and teach and recommend books for me to read and stuff like that. So I worked on a lot of stuff from that. And then I would study wrongful conviction cases. A lot of what I was trying to learn was I get 1,000 case submissions a month for people that want me to cover their cases. And I'm like, what do I look for? Like, what can I tell on the surface? Because I can't do a 6-month. I don't have the kind of show, you know, like Serial or This American Life. They come out and do 12 episodes of Serial, make $5, $10, $20 million, and then they, you know, relax for a year while they prep for the next one.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it's just like week by week. I go. I don't take weeks off. Go, 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 go. So, what can I see on the surface of a case that could indicate that it could be a wrongful conviction when I'm trying to screen cases?
Mm-hmm.
So I was researching a lot of these cases, and people had always – Robbie had told me that she got the idea for Serial from West of Memphis. And I'm like, right, yeah, that's no idea what she was talking about.
You're like, yes.
Yeah. And then people all the time, you know, our season 3 case involved a false confession. And people were like, it's like Jesse Ms. Kelly from West Memphis 3. And I'm like, exactly like that. Like, I had no idea.
So you kept hearing it, but didn't
know. I heard
know.
West Memphis 3 over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided one weekend, I think my wife was out of town for the weekend. I was like, well, there's some documentaries. I'm going to watch these documentaries.
Yeah.
And I saw immediately when I started watching Paradise Lost, I'm like, oh, I saw that movie, The Devil's Knot. That was about this case.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched the, and like my producer at the time, Mike, I was like tweeting him or like texting him real time. I'm like, holy shit, this case is crazy, blah, blah, blah. And then I watched part two of Paradise Lost. I'm like, yep. Mark Byers totally did it. You should see that. And then it was like part three, 4 hours later, I'm like, just kidding, not Mark. I think this is Terry Kyle. I'm just kidding. I think this case is nuts.
Uh-huh.
And then watched West Ham. So I watched all four of those documentaries in one weekend. And then on Monday morning, Mike came into work and we were sitting there talking about it. And it occurred to me while I was talking about the case, I was trying to explain to him the details of it. And I was like, I could not remember the names of the victims. Like, I couldn't remember them at all. And I was like, how did I just spend 8 hours watching documentaries on the same case? And I have no idea. It's not that they never said them, but it wasn't a primary piece of it, right?
Yeah.
And so I started looking at it a little more. And then I started, you know, luckily that case had a lot of online resources as far as the case file. So I started looking through them. And I was like, you know what? There's been a ton of investigative. It's a case I never would have thought I would have done because I like to cover cases no one's heard of before, you know, and bring them to light, and get them the help that they need. And this one, you know, they were already out. They already had all this, all the support that's been out there for the West Memphis Three.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, you know, the entire effort was to get those three out of prison. Nobody really ever focused on the victims. And what Jim Clementi has taught me is that a proper investigation has to begin with victimology. That's how you figure this thing out.
I love that.
And so I just had the idea, like, let's do it. Let's start from scratch. We'll make the most exhaustive, in-depth, investigative series anyone has ever done about this case. And I think we did it. We did 54, I think, something episodes that
Amazing.
Are around 45 mm-hmm. minutes to an hour, plus 50 some follow-up episodes to that. So, you know, you're talking, you know, like well over 100 hours, and it's every single, you know, it's not just the big stuff you see on TV. It's every element of that case.
Mm-hmm.
So much stuff about victimology that I think 90% of people, 99% of people that know the case were unaware of regarding the victims.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was just another one where it was like I just wanted to do it and see if we can put it to bed and solve it and get it done, and you know developed a relationship with I met Jesse Miss Kelly, but I developed a relationship with Jason Baldwin, became mm-hmm. really good friends with Damian Echols mm-hmm. throughout the process, and you know and I'm now involved with their legal team, and we were just in court a few months ago with that case, so it's like just did a TV docuseries on it, which is still bananas.
I watched that. So cool. I love that you got involved with that case even though it was big, and that you took this different approach of focusing on the victims. And I think I told you when I talked to you on your show that I watched your Crime Con presentation, The Forgotten West Memphis 3, mm-hmm. and I was really excited to go watch that because of that title, The Forgotten 3, The Victims. Because
right.
that happens far too often in large serial killer cases or wrongful convictions where the focus kind of goes elsewhere and we really like forgot what brought us here in the first place.
Right.
Because, you know, that wrongful conviction case wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the victim. And with that case, I was always obsessed with Angie Dodge. I work with one of my clients is one of her best friends from when she was younger. And mm-hmm. when Chris Tapp just this year, he actually got awarded over $11 million for his wrongful conviction, which he's been fighting for years. It's incredible.
That's awesome.
Like I'm so excited. So of course I did a little blurb, a little update at the beginning mm-hmm. of one of my episodes and just updated on the case and whatnot. And I mentioned Angie and, you know, like we need to keep her family in our thoughts still. And her friend, the next time I saw her, she was so grateful that I even mentioned Angie because she said that Angie's mom, Carol, had called her up and said she was like happy for Chris, but it was really hard for her to see,
sure.
you know, all this media in celebration for Chris. And she said, like, no media has mentioned Angie's name.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think it is important. Yeah.
So you would hear about the West Memphis 3 case, and so many times you'd hear the West Memphis 3 were freed after being convicted of murdering three innocent boys. They would never say their names. Yeah. You would always hear three innocent boys.
Three little boys, yeah.
Yeah. And that was, you know, funny story, when I did that presentation at CrimeCon, that was the day we sold the show to Oxygen.
Oh, really?
So we had pitched the show to Oxygen. So Jim Clemente is on my production team, along with John Cryer and his team. We had pitched to Oxygen, and we were just hadn't heard anything. And then I did the presentation, The Forgotten West Memphis 3, which wasn't in our pitch. Mm-hmm. That was what I titled my podcast season and what I titled the presentation. When I walked out of the presentation, I went back to my booth at CrimeCon. The executive from Oxygen, what happened, was in the audience and came up to the booth and said, "We want it. Let's do it. Let's make it."
Wow. So that's the day you got that.
Yep. Right then.
That is amazing. And Jim Clemente was there.
Yes.
Right. Yep. And then one other person. Who was the other? There's three of you, right?
Yeah. Well, Jim was there. John Cryer, Ducky, if you know You're Pretty in Pink, or Alan Harper, if you know You're Two and a Half Men.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
John was the driving force behind the show to begin. John is the one that originally came to me.
Wow. Okay.
Way back. And he was a listener and said, "Hey, I think we should make this into a TV show." And we were working, pitching it and stuff. And it's just a ton of work. I'll never do it again. It's just too much work.
So much work, I'm sure.
Yeah. And it's nowhere near the money. People think you're on TV. It's not great.
You're like,
not worth the months of your life that go into it. But it was worth it because it got the story out there in a very different way.
Yeah.
You know, I think like I'm really proud that we got to see through our show that you got to see the human side, the real side of Pam Hicks, and you got to see the human side of David Jacoby and learn so much more about Stevie, Michael, and Christopher, you know, throughout the, you know, those were things that I wanted to account. And it's resulted in us now being back in court to try to get DNA testing done. But John and I had pitched the show and we weren't getting much traction. And I was talking to Jim one day, and Jim has several shows through his production company. And like I said, he's been a mentor and a great friend of mine for a long time. So, you know, we brought him on the team, and then, you know, we kind of pitched it of us doing it together, and that's what ended up happening.
It just all came together. Very cool. So with the DNA, you guys went to court. They ordered that they were not going to test it. So, like, are you guys going back to court? Like, is there more fight to be done? Is there things people can do to, like, help advocate for that and, like, fight for that?
There will be. We're in a regrouping stage right now. So, because everybody's asking, like, what can I do? And I said, right now, just stay, hold the line right now, because we are. So it was the judge denied, first of all, the fact that the prosecutor can test the DNA any damn time they want to.
Yeah.
There was this whole mess that'll take an hour to explain, but it was when we finally pressured them in through the TV show enough to test the evidence, then the Cressman, the DA, said, "Oh, you know what? It's lost," and told the press that I think it was destroyed in a fire. And then the police chief came out and said it was destroyed in a fire years ago. And through all this year of fighting, we find out that no, it was just, you know, in the evidence room, but it could have been a good place to look for it. It was right there the whole time. And so then we're like, okay, so now we have it. We've all confirmed we have physically gone, not me, but the defense team physically went to the and we saw the ligatures that we want to test. Let's test them. And the DA said, "No, you're going to have to fight it out in court." So then we file this motion in court to go get a judge to order them to test it, thinking like this is a no-brainer. The Arkansas law is very clear. You have the right to test DNA. And so we go to court. And again, we're not saying exonerate them. Just let us test the evidence. We just want to prove who actually did this and put an end to this fucking nightmare after all these years.
Yeah.
And the judge, you know, that we had my audience raise the money to pay for an expert witness to come, and we had all this stuff all arranged. And then we walked in, and the judge said, "Oh, well, that law about DNA testing is under the habeas corpus law, which literally translates into show me the body. And since your body is no longer in custody, even though he's still convicted, you don't have the right to test your DNA and denied it. So that's so where like thing.
Complete bullshit. Like that is, yeah. That's, you don't have to provide the body to test the DNA. That's just stupid.
Yeah. And and by body, it literally means the offender's body, like being in custody of the state.
It's like, no, that's actually not true, because we talked about this a little bit too, where the DNA in Angie's case was tested after Chris was let out of prison and he was still convicted murderer. He was let out, convicted for that murder. They still fought super hard. They tested the DNA. They followed the guy out in Boise. They secretly followed him. They picked up one of his cigarette butts. They tested it. It was him. And then Chris gets exonerated. So yeah. Why can't it be the same in the West Memphis 3 case?
All the time. In states around the country, it happens all the time. The idea that you have to be in custody is ridiculous. Now, there are lawyers that will tell you that the judge was correct, because the Arkansas law does say it's under habeas, and since he's not in custody, it doesn't apply. And there are lawyers that will tell you that she was wrong, because it lists in the law 3 circumstances. And, you know, it's like that they're in custody and are trying to get her, or they're unavailable. And then it says, or they are declaring or testing that they are actually innocent. It says, or if they're saying they're actually innocent, which is what Damien Echols is saying.
Right.
And, you know, again, I'm not a lawyer. There are lawyers that say that or means what it means, means it is not conditional to the things before it. And there are other lawyers that go, no, it doesn't matter because it's still in habeas. But where we're at now is we're appealing that up to – it looks like it's going to go to the Arkansas State Supreme Court. So the decision's being appealed. In the meantime, there are efforts going on for us to try to get some people within Arkansas to sponsor a bill to change the law. And literally all it has to say is just add a sentence that says you have the right to test DNA whether you're in custody or not.
Absolutely. And that's a no-brainer.
And we've got some pretty good traction there, too. There are a few, several, actually, lawmakers in Arkansas that seem to be on board with that. So yeah. It's kind of a two-pronged approach. But right now, like, everybody's like, what can we do? What can we do? It's like, I don't know yet. We have to
like
wait.
Like, we're kind of waiting. Yeah.
I'm waiting to get my marching orders from Damien's attorneys, and we'll see from there.
Yeah, I think everyone's so anxious to, like, help, because it's such a tragic case. Like, yes, it's a wrongful conviction, but just the crime itself is so horrific and tragic, and like it pains me because it's kids, and that's like what I'm most passionate about. And it's just like, it's not fair that they've gone this long without justice and without who has, you know, obviously whoever committed this crime has been out all of these years, because those 3 that were convicted were clearly wrongfully convicted. Although, you know, you said there will always be naysayers, but I think it's
someone's
pretty
going
clear
to say on the internet about this episode that you were wrong about that.
I know. Absolutely. But, you know, it's just from everything I've seen and the wrongful convictions, and I don't remember if they had a similar, I don't remember who kind of looked at their wrongful conviction, but I had watched a video on it, and it's sad when they use people. And like, I always actually feel bad to say it, but when they target people with the IQs that are lower, that they are able to manipulate, because that is really what happens. That's what happened in Angie's case, which, again, I hate to say, he's smart and he is like an amazing person, but at that time, he was just able to be manipulated with that. And it's so like unfair, and like they're taking so much advantage of these people. And it's not worth the conviction.
Well, and people will say that about Jesse Miss Kelly, too. You know, he like had an IQ test that showed 72. And there are people out there that will tell you he faked it, because if you look at a different test he took, he got 77 and he got 80 on another, which are all still pretty low IQs. But it doesn't matter, because as the experts will tell you, the suggestibility is not the same as intelligent. Yes, people with a lower IQ tend to be more suggestible, but also being young tends to make people more suggestible. And certain people just have that personality. And you hear it so clearly with Jesse Miss Kelly. Like, whatever they say, It was like, what time was it? 9 a.m. You sure it wasn't later? It was noon. It was getting dark, right? Yeah. Like, whatever they say, he just says yes
He's
to.
He's like, sure, exactly.
At one point, I had pulled the transcript and cut out just Jesse's words. And I don't remember the numbers now. It's been too many years. But it was like, it's something like 90-some percent of his responses in his interview, where he's the one talking, are yes, yup, uh-huh. Like, it's just him agreeing with shit. Yeah.
Yep.
It's never him articulate. And anytime he does articulate something that actually happened, whatever he's articulating is provably false. The evidence shows that's not what happened.
Right. It's wild that people aren't able to kind of look at that and critically think. Because obviously you taking that deep look, it's so clear to you. So I hope that what you guys are doing for that case will really like come full circle. And it's a hard fight, obviously, and so frustrating when things don't go through. But hopefully just with time, something can happen. You have a pretty good idea of who you think it might be, right?
Yeah, I have someone who I think that is probably the best. It's funny you say that, because someone just texted me today and said, "Are you?" They said, "So you're pretty sure that this person is the one that did it, right?" And I said, "No." And by the way, and this is a private conversation. This is not just me like pretending on the internet.
Right.
This is a private conversation I had, and I said, "I don't know until we get DNA testing done. I can't say who I think did it, and based on my investigation, I think that this person is a very good suspect, but that they could be completely innocent. We need to do testing. That's what I want to do, is just do the testing."
Yes. So you can kind of get an idea. Obviously, like, I've watched those things. There is a certain person that is a little suspicious, but with DNA testing.
Well, the thing we got to be careful about is, you know, especially working in the wrongful conviction space, is to not make the same mistakes original investigators made, which is to get tunnel vision without evidence.
Yes. Yeah, no, I love that approach where you can like look at these other things, but why, like, you can't actually make a definite decision without that DNA.
Yeah, I think that if investigators were looking, if they had put the same scrutiny on other suspects, they would have easily been convicted on the circumstantial evidence that's out there. The circumstantial evidence surrounding, say, Terry Hobbs is much stronger than the circumstantial evidence that ever surrounded Damien, Jason, and Jesse.
Yeah.
You know, it's by leaps and bounds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean that he did it, but it should tell you that if we're willing to give him a pass on all this stuff, that you got to have the same standard on both sides here, you know?
Yeah, because those three are still all, like, kind of like Chris was. They're considered the convicted murderer, but they were let out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
they're still convicted murderers.
And that's hard. Just find jobs and like go about your normal life. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is.
So before we kind of end out, like, thank you for all that information, first of all, because it's just like incredible insight into those two cases and into wrongful convictions. I wanted to ask just a little, when you see cases that are like pretty popular and they're starting to get traction on like maybe they are wrongfully convicted, I just kind of wanted to see kind of your idea. I saw that Rabia might be working with Scott Peterson. So how do you kind of go about like getting rid of that tunnel vision? I don't know what you think on it. There's just a few cases where like that one is so hard for me to like get past, I guess, what I've been told. And I know about wrongful convictions. So how do you kind of put that to the side? And then as you get into it, comes down to it that you find that they're not, you know, wrongfully convicted, kind of like Maggie Freeling did in that coverage she did.
Murdered Alliance. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you, you know, kind of come back and just put it out on the table? Like, I investigated it and like I did what
You've got to do what Maggie did, which is to be honest with your listeners. Mm-hmm. The thing is, like, if you work in the space, I get 100 emails a week or messages a week telling me how biased I am about whatever case I'm working. Right now I'm working on a case out of a triple homicide out of Pinyon Pines, California, by Palm Springs. And there are people right away, they're like, oh, you're biased. And you think, even though I'm saying over and over again, when I start the investigation, in that case, we're 30 episodes in. And I'm still like, I don't know if they were wrong. Right. We're investigating this to figure out if they're wrongfully convicted. And I've always made, we had one season eight where it turns out, tragically, the person we were working with passed away in prison of COVID. But we were right on the brink, if you were listening to that season, of me saying, like, I don't know. Like, as I'm looking at the evidence, I'm not sure that she was wrongfully convicted. And in that case, we never had to get to a point where I had to really make a stand on it because she passed away. There was enough there that I was saying, you know what? I think we're going to move on. We can't help her now. She's gone. And so we shifted our focus into helping her daughter, you know, to help with burial. You know, we did a GoFundMe and helped her with the burial expenses and stuff like that.
That's awesome.
And just moved on from the case. But, you know, it's like it was Scott Peterson. I don't know anything about that case. But I will tell you is Robbie has a new podcast called Robbie and Ellen Solve the Case.
Yeah, with Ellen Marsh
from the Obsessed Network.
Yeah.
And they did an episode. I actually was on their kind of follow-up episode, their Instagram Live they did on it. Because they had some questions about boating. So that was my role in the whole thing. but it's a perfect example. And I couldn't tell you at all if he's innocent or guilty. I have no idea. I mean, just in general, I've seen like what Nancy Grace said, and I'm not a fan. So I'm like, well, hopefully she was wrong. but listening to Robbie and Ellen break it, you know, Robbie is just spitting facts. That's all she's doing is saying, and she got so much hate for because so many people are convinced that he's 100% guilty, but she was just like, here's the, and I don't remember what the numbers were, but it was like, here's the 22 people that said they saw Lacey walking her dog that day. That were never admitted into, that were never allowed to testify at trial. And here, it was like all this evidence. It was enough for me when I listened to it, and I trust Robbie enough to know, like, she's got nothing to gain by changing anything. Yeah. And I was like, that's like, how do you argue with that? I can't be one of those people on the internet that was like, don't try confusing me with your facts. I've already made my mind up. You
know, it's like, totally.
So I don't know. But that's the way you do it. That's the way I do it. And, you know, it's made my show less popular. My show was much more popular. If you go back to season one and two and three, where like it was like I had the convicted person on the phone doing interviews with them all the time, much like Serial, where you hear from them all the time. And then I got to a point when I did the West Memphis 3 case where I was like, if we're truly trying to find the truth and get evidence from the victim, I don't want to manipulate, because it was like you want to have do a story about someone who's likable, right? And it was like, but it just kind of, I just kind of questioned. It's like, well, why? It shouldn't matter if they like them.
No.
And I know how to investigate a case, and the way you investigate is you go from ground zero and you gather evidence and you look at witness statements, you compare that to the evidence, you develop hypotheses and compare them to the evidence. It's got nothing to do with the person that's already locked up. So I've now, in the more recent seasons, you know, like the season we're doing right now, we're 30 episodes in, you haven't heard from the defendant. I've spoken to him, but the listener hasn't heard from him because we're covering the evidence of the case and going the places where the investigation either went or should go in the proper order. And they just, and it's just like, there are people like this, like, why haven't we heard about the case against Robert and Christian yet? I'm like, because there's no fucking evidence. All the evidence is pointing over here, and you want to look over here. Like, we're not there.
Yeah. Right.
But that's, so to me, that's how you sleep at night when you're doing this, and you handle the hate and don't give a shit, because I know what I'm doing, and I know where my motivations are, and it's just simply to find the truth. And you just,
as long as your intentions,
facts. You investigate and report facts.
Yeah. I like that approach where you're, like, not trying to tell a single story, but you're trying to just present it openly and have an open mind. I'm going to have to listen to that episode. I've listened to Patrick and Jillian talk about Scott Peterson, and back then, who knows what their stances are now. They covered him a while ago, but, you know, Jillian was like me, like, no, he did it. And Patrick was like, I don't know. So I'm really curious to go listen to the Robbie and Ellen one. I have a case that a lot of people think this lady is rightfully convicted, and I think she probably isn't. And so I've seen that what you see where people are like so strong on it. I don't know if you know it, the Darlie Routier case. It's pretty infamous.
Yeah, I know that case.
And I haven't done like a crazy deep dive myself. It's just always one I've had in the back of my mind because she's on death row, and I think I kind of believe she's innocent. I'd have to, you know, look further into it, but when I see forums talking about her, people are so determined to, you know, write these things that they think are fact, but then I've heard, right, you know, the opposite, like that's not really presented to you as, yeah, like as you think it was, like this is, you're not, you know, hearing this new evidence, kind of like you said. So yeah. I like
her
that
case
idea.
Is a tough one. I actually looked into her case. It was pitched to me a while back.
Uh-huh.
And I actually exchanged a couple letters with her. And I didn't come to a conclusion that she was guilty, but I wasn't convinced enough to, yeah, commit the. And also, she seems to have this thing where, and I've heard from a couple other creators that had the same type of situation where, like, you get, uh-huh, in contact, you talk to them, and then you're like, okay, well, let's move to the next step, and then she kind of ghosts you, or her team ghosts you, or whatever. So
it's like, yeah,
it's a complicated case.
That's one I'm on the fence about, where it's like, I, you know, I've been convinced, like, maybe she is, but then I'm always telling people, I don't know, I'd feel really guilty if she isn't, like, if she really did,
right,
it, because her poor kids. So you kind of do have that inner conflict, I think, regardless of kind of what you think. Like, you obviously hope you're on the, yeah, right track.
Yeah, and I think that the key is just to, like, when you're not sure, don't be sure.
Right.
And that's where people make the mistake. Like, the internet doesn't work that way, right? You don't get to be not sure. Everybody has to have 100% black and white. And, like, mm-hmm, I don't operate that way. If I'm not positive, if I'm not sure, then I'll just be not sure. And we'll just keep trying to find answers.
Yeah, I just said that to my husband the other day. Like, true crime is not black and white. It is, like, so, yeah, many gray areas, looking into a case and deciding how you feel. But I just kind of wanted to see your little stance on a case like that. And I really appreciate you coming on here with me. Like I said, that was a lot of insight that, like, I couldn't have provided my listeners myself. So I appreciate it. I think it will, like, do well for them in looking into these cases and just, like, double checking themselves when it comes to, like, wrongful convictions and, you know, their opinions.
Yeah, well, it's my pleasure. I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you loved Bob Ruff, make sure to give him a follow on all social media. You can find Bob Ruff, Truth and Justice Podcast, and the True Crime Binge Podcast on Instagram, Twitter, and other social media platforms. You can visit their websites and just make sure to show Bob some love. I'll have all the links to his socials posted in the show notes.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why my Lowe's Rewards members get a free Valspar paint or exterior stain sample to test your look to confidently refresh your space. Offer valid in-store only 87 to 820. Limit one per customer while supplies last. Discount taken in time of purchase. See associate for details. Rewards program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets, with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.